Hello and welcome to Sustainable Binghamton Radio. I'm your host, Hadassah Head, and today I'll be interviewing Professor Richard Shaker in the Geography Department and Environmental Science.
Nice to meet you. I look forward to talking with you.
Great. So I guess we'll start with who you are and a little bit about your background, what you've done, your research interests, as well as maybe some volunteer interests. Anything just relevant about yourself and sustainability?
Sure. I guess I have to go back probably to my high school days, and you've probably heard of Organic Valley. Organic Valley is in my hometown or that region. That's the Kickapoo Valley in Wisconsin. So I guess I was exposed to this kind of environmental or land ethic at an early age, and it was just all around us. We didn't think anything of it. We just kind of thought that's how the whole world operated. Nonetheless, I went to college in Wisconsin. I went to the University of Wisconsin La Crosse, was geography major, earth science, went to Milwaukee for my master's degree, focused on landscape ecology and how agriculture land affects fish. So looking at herbicides, pesticides, soilification, just the runoff models, and looking at major, like broad scale, 22 watersheds for my master's degree. And then for my PhD, I was always really interested in studying humans. Humans are very complex, as you know, and they're very difficult to model and to understand. So I figure if I learn the math and how to do my analyses on fish, I can kind of transfer that knowledge to humans. So ultimately, the same kind of ideas, this human-landscape interaction was the same as looking at fish and agriculture land. But now I look at the global scale, and I look at urbanization in the context of how are we planning our landscapes.
Wow. Okay, that was a lot of experience there. So how do you define sustainability? Since people, you know, it's become such a buzzword these days, sustainability, that sometimes we have to really look at what do we mean when we say it. So how do you see sustainability?
That's a really good question. I focused sustainability in my dissertation research, so I had to investigate it quite thoroughly. Initially, I think of sustainability now as survivability. So that was historically the first sustainability. If we go back to when we first started thinking about it as maybe scientists looking back at ourselves, that would be more sustainable yield in the 16th century, looking at how we build our wooden boats for colonialism, and we had our forests that we needed to manage that. Of course, 1987, it got repopularized and brought into the international circuit as this idea of, you know, using our resources and living in a way that we don't compromise future generations. So I guess it's a sustainability is that concept of, you know, living in a way that we can do that kind of behavior indefinitely. And that makes it very difficult because it's very complex. We have to remove the connotation between sustainable, something that is continuous, and development, so growth. You can't have continuous growth on a planet with finite resources. It makes it very difficult. So I guess living in a way that we can live like that and the generations that come after us can also do that.
So you've talked a little bit about your research. Can you make a few directed statements about how your research relates to sustainability and maybe how it can be directly used? Because sometimes when we talk about academia, it's like, okay, yeah, it's about this topic, but how does it apply to real life?
That's a really good question, and that's one of the things I was really scared about when I first came into academia. Was I going to lose the pragmatic approach? I really love the theory and the mind thought and growth that you have at academia, but how do you take that knowledge and really make it into something applied? And in sustainability planning, or if you look at management, we call it operationalizing sustainability, and that was my goal from the start. And I really look at the global scale. So humanity is going to continue to grow in terms of population, maybe spike around 14 billion, maybe a little bit more than that. And then it's supposed to level off at about 9.1 billion by 2100. However, through that whole time, we're going to continue to urbanize. In 2007, we crossed that threshold from being more an agrarian-based society to a more urban-based society. And that's supposed to continue to grow even after we reach population stability. We're still going to see that rural to urban migration.
I have a question about that.
Uh-huh.
With the Binghamton Regional Sustainability Coalition, we talk a lot about smart growth. We've been involved with putting on smart growth summits with the city and county. So when we talk smart growth, oftentimes we want urbanization.
Mm-hmm.
The fear is more along the lines of the suburban sprawl and, you know, spreading things out. Where does suburbanization fit in?
Absolutely. And suburbanization, exurbanization, those lower density urban forms that we see is still classified as urbanization, but we can further define it as density relative kind of questions. And going back to my research is really looking at that. So I see humanity as being the number one changing agent on the planet, and we're going to continue to urbanize. So that gives us an opportunity over the next 100 years for us really to focus on our urbanization, because we're going to see that's major growth, major movement from humans and the transition. With that said, there's still going to be less than 2% of the planet, the terrestrial landscape, where humans and urbanization will be. Okay, so the rest of it, the rest of the roughly 30% of the planet, is going to be everything else. So my research really looks at, if that's the case, if we're going to continue to urbanize and we're going to continue to migrate to cities, how should we develop and plan our cities more appropriately? So looking at sprawl, like you mentioned, one of the things in my research that I've found is that you control for sprawl. And this is something that we think of and we try to do with our smart growth initiatives. Mm-hmm. If you do not allow the city to continue to grow spatially or laterally outward, you have to force it to work within itself. So there's plenty, and if you take Binghamton for an example, there are plenty of businesses and buildings that we see, brownfields, for instance, mm-hmm. that we could provide incentives to redevelop those areas, opposed to just, oh, we'll just buy some land outside of the city and continue to spread it out,
right.
Which has been the tradition. Has been the tradition since after World War II here in the United States. So my research, I develop indicators of sustainability. And so I have to have a measuring stick, some kind of benchmark or calibrating mechanism that I can look at the landscape. I'm considered a spatial ecologist.
How many are there of in the world of spatial ecologists?
I have no idea. That's a great question. Some people call themselves landscape ecologists, and some people call themselves macroecologists or spatial or human geographers, or there's all kinds of different names. Mm-hmm. Spatial ecologist, it's a little bit more broad, because you're the species in which you're interested in, the taxa. If it's flora or fauna, it doesn't matter. That's the whole idea. Because if you're an ecologist, you can look at all of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't, and the scale changes. Landscape ecologists focus on landscapes. A watershed is an example of a landscape, but mm-hmm. that can be scalar too. You can have larger and smaller mm-hmm. Watersheds. But nonetheless, if you use these indicators, you can, and if they're applied appropriately, you can measure the design of the landscape. So I've been looking at, for my dissertation, I looked at the whole country of Moldova. And they have this thing called a landscape unit that comes out of the Russian School of Geography
mm-hmm.
that combines what we would find in like an ecoregion, which is vegetation, climate factors, other issues with your physical structure of the landscape. You have watersheds that are mainly built off of topography and elevation, but landscape unit combines things that you would see like in a county. So we have our counties, which are arbitrary kind of boundary areas, mm-hmm. and then you have these natural boundary areas, and they smashed it together. And we don't really have anything like that here in the Western kind of viewpoint. So you take Europe, or if you take the United States, and our political boundaries are separate from our natural boundaries. So that was kind of this attractive thing that when I went to Moldova and did my research there, it's like, wow, you have this boundary area that kind of takes in a majority of human behaviors also with the environment. So
Sounds like a well-thought-out study. Are you currently looking at anything that's going on in Binghamton? You mentioned the brownfields and things like that. Do you have any intent, even if you're not working currently, on studying the Binghamton area?
Yeah, so I'm still new to the Binghamton area. I'm teaching this environment.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm teaching an environmental planning capstone class for environmental studies, and I've set up the class into groups that go out and work with communities, community organizations. Mm-hmm. So right now I'm still learning who's here in terms mm-hmm. of the organization.
Assets.
The stakeholders, and I'm trying to figure out what's here. I see issues, obviously. When you come in as a scientist, you look at things, and I've received notice that I was going to come here for a job, I was looking at the area to set up a local paradigm of research. Brownfields, absolutely something that's an interest of mine. Most people think of it as an environmental burden for an area. I think of it as an economic opportunity for Binghamton. Obviously, the fracking issue is something. I have a strong background in water, so I will have my ear to the ground and be paying attention very closely with that, and understanding that fracking has economic benefits, but it also has some serious environmental problems that can arise that could be ultimately very serious. So if we're going to pursue that avenue in this area, we really need to, you know, take it slow. I'm also really interested in just urbanization, urban growth, and those movement patterns, and kind of studying this area as an ecosystem. So all of it, the triple bottom line, the social economics and the environmental factors that make up the greater Binghamton area.
If there are students listening right now and they're interested in getting into the types of research that you do, or getting involved right now in the types of research you do, what types of advice would you give them?
Well, first off, I suppose you could just come talk to me. Mm-hmm. We can talk more. But I really try to make my research applied, pragmatic. You know, there is a theoretical element, and I try to use the most advanced techniques that I know of, that I've been taught, to apply them to things like landslides, groundwater quality issues, you know, fish population migrations, human behavior, crime. So if you're interested in something that's, you know, relevant to humans and the growth, and we can say that all those things, if we're improving humanity, that's really improving sustainability. So any of those questions that are relevant to that, I mean, that's stuff that I'm interested in. So mm-hmm. So my local paradigm, obviously Greater Binghamton. I'm looking at also statewide for the state of New York. I'm really interested in developing a water quality coalition that looks at biological indicators that gives us an indication on water quality. And there has
so aside from just looking at sediment or salt or those types of indicators, mm-hmm. is that primarily what is used to look at water?
Yeah, those things, so those chemical components, they give you a great day-to-day indication, but you don't see the extremes. So if we look at biological components, macroinvertebrates, those water bugs, or fish, they have a niche, a specific kind of range of conditions that they live in. So actually those biological components give you a much better indication of what the water quality really is. If you live next to, let's say, a smokestack and it was blowing in your window, you would move. Mm-hmm. Fish and the bugs, the water bugs, macroinvertebrates, don't have the opportunity to leave. So they really give you a really strong indication.
So you're saying just to count them, or... How would this work?
Yeah, well, hopefully we can get some citizens involved with this, and I think the local schools, I think a lot of science programs at high schools would be very much interested in this. But there are indexes that are built off of the types of bugs, the macroinvertebrates, or the types of fish. Fish are a little bit more expensive to work with because you have to do different sampling techniques, but in terms of the macroinvertebrates, that's a relatively easy a data collection technique that we could do for the whole state of New York, and I think it's something that we should really look into.
Have you heard of the NOAA Project? I think there's a group of people that are trying to collect biodiversity information here in the area.
I have heard of it. I think it's fantastic, and this this avenue that I'm talking about with the macroinvertebrates or fish would absolutely addend nicely to that. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anybody doing this across the whole state of New York. Right. I think people are doing it on local watersheds, and which I think it's a great idea, but if we could collectively, we could set this up for the whole state of New York.
Yeah.
Another topic, obviously, is the recent flooding. Mm-hmm.
I would assume that it is related, well, one, to climate change, but two, to paving over wetlands and leveling trees on hills. That was kind of my not knowing too much about the situation understanding of it.
Well, I think you're headed in the right direction, and it is a very complex question. It's can be as broad as global temperature change and looking at how the ocean currents have modified those effects, the climatic effects and weather effects over Greater Binghamton. Mm-hmm. And we have to also take into account that it was raining almost nonstop for the month prior to the tropical storm coming here, so the ground was saturated already. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot more overland flow than infiltration. So that obviously went into it. Urbanization is always a factor that's associated with that. And I think really looking at the design of the landscape, the urban kind of components, have we done things in the recent past and in the last, 20, 30 years, maybe 50 years, that have changed our landscape, that we have kind of modified or disrupted that hydrologic cycle?
Could you use some smaller words there? hydrological cycle, for instance?
Sure. The landscape has a potential, it has its own characteristics of letting the water infiltrate or soak into the land. Mm-hmm. And if we...
Sponginess?
Sure. Sponginess works. And if you put a pavement up or a blacktop or some type of parking lot or something, for instance...
Or even just compression, right?
Compression also of soil, absolutely. So just even if you have construction going on, and you have those large trucks, for instance, so we see that around the university, mm-hmm. that compacts the soil and makes it more difficult to have that infiltration. So there's numerous different factors, and you really have to look at the whole watershed and also how the storms come up and down the Susquehanna watershed area, and so it's a math question, it's a temporal question, looking at historical information. Obviously 2006 and now 2011, we've seen two significant storms here that makes us wonder if we're seeing a nonlinear relationship. Mm-hmm. So seeing something that's changing in the recent time period, and it's enough that we should really investigate it. Mm-hmm. We saw a lot of damage done culturally, environmentally, economically to the area. So we need to be aware. And are there certain strategies that we could do to prevent this in the future? I think yes.
That's a hopeful note. What other components to your research do you have beyond the local element?
Sure. So Greater Binghamton obviously is a strong interest of mine, the state of New York, but I also have an international component, very interested still in Eastern Europe, but quite recently, and it's always been in the back of my mind, is looking at the global system. So I'm starting to look at all of the countries and looking at how do these different cultures shape their landscape, and how does that really relate to sustainability? The simplest analogy I can give you is like a mouse trying to get to some cheese on a maze. You can manipulate that maze to make the mouse either have a harder time or a faster time in terms of getting to that cheese. So we are urbanizing, and we are improving. I've seen that trend. So even though urbanization has looked at this really bad situation, but globally that urbanization is putting more population in a smaller area, making it more efficient. Mm-hmm. So, but are there specific design principles that we can add into that? This idea of urban design has been really repopularized with the advent of geographic information systems and science and spatial mm-hmm. statistics. It really lost its kind of heat in the 60s, maybe even prior to that, the 1950s. The idea of being a planner or designer was this great visionary of how we should look at or how our landscape should look in the future. Well, now we have the capabilities of testing that. And so through the scientific method, we can really look at what are good and bad kind of strategies and plans.
Cool. All right. Well, I guess with on that note, we will conclude our interview for today. And I am hoping everyone enjoyed that interview as much as I did. And hopefully we'll have Professor Richard Shaker back on the radio on our other program, Cocoa Conversations, Exploring Complex Systems. Okay. Bye-bye.